Why do women have abortions?
I can remember the exact moment when I knew I was going to have to write this book. There was a caller to the hotline who wanted to schedule an abortion. And she told me, well, I can't be pregnant because if my ex finds out I'm pregnant, he's going to come to my house and shoot my kids. It was such a jaw-dropping moment. In fact, this memory of mine appears almost verbatim in the novel Mercy Street. It's something that happens to my character, Claudia, when she's answering calls on this hotline. But I remember when this woman said this to me, I thought, oh my God, I really don't know anything. You know, I'd been pro-choice my whole life, and I thought I had some understanding of the reasons why women choose abortion. But I will tell you, that had never crossed my mind, that that might be a reason someone would make this choice.
That's Jennifer Haig. We talk with her about her new novel, Mercy Street. But first, we talk with No Violet Bulawayo about her powerful new allegorical novel about the fall of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe and the chaos and opportunity that rose in its wake. It's called Glory. That and more are all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. No Violet Bulawayo gained acclaim for her first novel, We Need New Names. It was a finalist for the Booker Prize and received many other awards. Her new novel, Glory, bids fair to win similar acclaim. A trenchant satire inspired by George Orwell's Animal Farm, Glory follows the fall of the old horse, leader of the fictional African nation of Jidada. His fall brings great hope that justice will finally come, decades after Jidada's revolution against colonialism. A young goat, Destiny, all the characters in the book are animals, lost her father when the revolution became a dictatorship. Now she hopes things will be different. What Destiny learns about her own country's history and its fight for freedom is more than a metaphor for Zimbabwe. It holds lessons for all people who fight for justice for themselves, their families, their nation, and the world. No Violet Bulawayo, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Glory, this is a thinly disguised Swiftian parody of Zimbabwe's political history, the Mugabe regime and its aftermath. You said in an interview that this book, quote, felt like responding to a call of duty. What did you mean by that?
I am coming from the belief that to, at least for me personally, to be an artist means to be engaged with the times. And Glory felt like that kind of project that asked me to engage with such a momentous time in Zimbabwe's history, which was the fall of Robert Mugabe on November 14, 2017, and the aftermath that followed. For those who are not aware of Zimbabwean history, at least the recent Zimbabwean history, Robert Mugabe had been in power for close to four decades before his ouster by coup in 2017. It was a complicated moment of hope and optimism, complicated in the sense that the guy who was going to take over had actually been his deputy. But still, there was an overall feeling that it was still a moment of turning a corner, because shortly we had seen the West and things could not get any worse than what we had been through. And of course, 2018, we had an election that quickly proved to us how mistaken we had been in that hope, as it became clear that the change that we had hoped for was not coming. And beyond that, we were still in the same unfortunate predicament. So Glory was my way of telling a story that I've seen unfold, but also telling beyond that story to the hope that I felt obligated to write toward, to create, of course, in a fictional sense. But I'd come to the realization that, you know, as a creative, I had to give something to the space that was Zimbabwe, by way of dreaming for a future that I wanted to see, a Zimbabwe that I hoped to see. So that is, yeah, that is the story of how Glory was born.
Now, No Violet Bulawayo is a pen name. Bulawayo features in this book. Tell us a little bit about your own history in relationship to the events of the book that they recount. They really do go back to independence and the revolution against colonialism. So tell us just a little bit about your own history in relationship to this.
So I was born right after independence from British colonial rule. So I'm a child of the 80s, a child of promise. But it was a complicated time because between the years of 1983 to 1987, the country witnessed a wave of mass killings that saw an estimated 20,000 people dead. And of course, that's the figure is loose. That's just an estimate. I'm not sure how close to accuracy that is. And that happened in the predominantly Ndebele regions of the country. The area is called Matebeleland, and it also happened in Manicaland as well. So in as much as it had strong, it happened along ethnic lines, there were people of non-Ndebele origin who were killed as well, who suffered as well, because it was Robert Mugabe's way of getting rid of the opposition. Now that period figures in Glory because it's a story that is really important for me. It's a story that needs to be told. It's a part of Zimbabwean history that we have tried to sweep under the carpet or deny or complicate. And of course, when it comes to the page, there is no better sight than to speak the unspeakable. In the fictional country of Chidada, I invent a region called Bulawayo. There is a place called Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. It's my hometown. It's my hometown. It's where I grew up. But Bulawayo in Chidada is fictional. I was really attracted to the name Bulawayo itself, which is not a beautiful name. It's a name that speaks of tragedy. It literally translates to a place of slaughter. So as somebody who's interested in names and naming, I thought, okay, there's actually no better way of naming this place where atrocities happen in the fictional country of Chidada. So that's where the real story and the fictional story and my own background kind of collide.
And how courageous to take the name of a place that means slaughter. I mean, how was that? How is that for you? You did this voluntarily.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. It's layered. It's a complicated name. I wish it was, you know, it had a better meaning. But the thing is that it's, you know, it's you can't run from reality, no matter how difficult, no matter how ugly. But at the same time, Bulawayo, the real place, my hometown, is also a place of so much, you know, complexity, so much beauty. I have fond memories of growing up there. It's still my favorite city. There's so much art, for instance, so much culture. And there really is a way in which places end up going beyond their names. I don't know if that makes sense. That, of course, the name is there but then a place can turn out to be something else. And more than anything, I'm interested in just acknowledging the memory that, yes, this kind of thing happened in this particular place. But there's also more to it.
And that kind of complexity really does run through your book. I'm going to return to that theme in just a minute. But first, this book, Glory, this novel, is a kind of Animal Farm. I mean, the characters are animals. You know, Mugabe is the old horse. Tuvi, who takes over from him, who is a stand-in for Emerson. I'm not sure I pronounce his name correctly. Mnangagwa.
It's close.
Mnangagwa. He is. He's also a horse. He's called the savior in the book. But then there are the defenders. These are the security forces. They're dogs. Talk about the defenders and, you know, who they represent in reality.
The defenders are this vicious pack of dogs who in reality represents the security forces, the police and the army. And of course, we know that in a space, in a situation of, you know, tyranny, is always the police and the security forces that are not only doing the dirty work for the leadership, but they are also protecting them while at the same time dishing out, in some cases, the most heartbreaking violence towards citizens. So that's who the defenders are. That's who the dogs are.
Right. And so this book is written in some ways from two points of view. One is that of the tyrants who are there, whether that's Mugabe or that's Tuvi, and that of the people. You know, those are the two points of view that we really hear about. And I was so interested because you really explore the contradictions in the point of view of the people. You say, for example, we'd be cheering one moment and then we'd remember what we'd been reduced to over the years and weep. And I wonder if you could talk about that experience, you know, the hope that ever springs again, memory and how it's suppressed, you know, all the contradictory ways in which people's emotions are played in a situation of tyranny like this. And I have to say, I'm beginning to feel the same way in my own country. I certainly did through the years of Trump and the fear of what's ahead. So can you talk about this psychological contradiction?
I was interested in how spaces of violence, not just physical, visible violence, but psychological violence, actually messes up the people who have to deal with it. You know, they are, for instance, the moment that you just alluded to is a moment of joy. But then because people have been through so much disappointment, people have been beaten down, those moments are no longer as pure as they would be anymore, because behind them is the memory of another time when they went through whatever they went through. And those moments kind of tend to show up randomly to complicate whatever people are feeling. And it's quite interesting. It was interesting to witness this back in 2017 when, you know, we all woke up to the news that, you know, our long-serving leader had been deposed. While you were celebrating, there were people actually weeping because of things like the Kukuraundi, weeping because of things that they had gone through at different points. You know, so it was a complicated joy. Yes, he's gone, but there's this thing that happened and it's not resolved for me. So I was interested in what those moments looked like and what those moments meant.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with No Violet Bulawayo about her new novel, Glory. And you mentioned the Gukurandi. That was the time in the early 80s when all that terrible violence went on. I mean, of course, the terrible violence continued on, but not in that kind of sweeping sense that you spoke about before. So this is a book also about deep, deep trauma, not just of a people and a country, but the individuals within it. So tell us about your character's destiny and her mother, Simiso. How do I pronounce her mother's name?
You pronounced it perfectly. It's pronounced how it's spelled. Destiny is a young bot who is returning to Jidada from the wherevers. And the reason that she left was because of violence and trauma. I think she leaves around 2008, which in the real country was a time of a violent, an election full of hope, but that turned violent when Mugabe refused to leave. So it's around that time that Destiny leaves. She comes back 10 years later after the fall of the person she associates with her trauma. Ambivalent, of course, about home, because it's complicated for her. Home has become this place that actually forced her out. But she returns to find that her own mother, Simiso, actually has her own secret history of trauma. And it becomes a sad but necessary moment of reconciling both their histories, sharing their stories. And of course, for Destiny, she goes on to write a book about these different traumas, these different histories. And what I was interested there is the idea of reconciling with our pasts, of confronting our pasts, and most importantly, of putting them on record, you know, of speaking them so they are out there, with the hope that once they are out there, they become collective stories, as it happens in Glory, because once Destiny writes her book, I won't spoil the book for the reader, but there is a moment in which the story goes beyond her and her mother and becomes and opens up to the community. We have the memorial, the Gukurandi memorial, that comes about as a result of the sharing and processing of those stories.
As, in fact, you are doing in this book, No Violet Bulawayo, in your wonderful novel, Glory, this whole way in which the people live in fear for decades and decades, and then at a certain point, they lose their fear. Could you talk Yes. about that process?
You know, I've realized that in as much as we speak of tyranny, and in the case where it seems to endure for as long as we have seen it happen in spaces like Zimbabwe, I feel like there's a way in which citizens also become participants, become enablers of that tyranny. And the most obvious being this sense of hopelessness, you know, that, okay, it's how it is. They own the country. Let them run it. It doesn't matter if we vote, they will win. This resignation. And of course, there are layers of complication behind that stance that I do understand. If the regime is violent, for instance, people will rather choose to just stand on the sidelines. But by taking that position, they're actually saying, okay, we're going to stand here and let this tyranny run its course. In Glory, there comes to a point where people just decide that no, enough is enough. And interestingly, that choice to actually stand up without them doing much of anything, there is some violence, yes, but the mere effect of people saying we are not having it anymore, a moment that is shared by the defenders, the dogs, the security forces, who also decide that, look, why are we standing against people who are actually going through the same thing that we are going through. And the dogs actually decide not to raise their weapons against the citizens. It becomes that that kind of turning point. And that's the story that I'm interested in. That's the story that I hope people existing in similar conditions, not just in Jidada or Zimbabwe, but all across the world where tyranny exists, I'm interested in what they make of that story.
Yeah, and we're confronting that right now when it comes to, you know, the invasion of Ukraine, and also in this book where the roots of the corruption, the roots of the violence are really in colonialism. So I wonder if you could talk about that broader message of, you know, of violence and the violence of corruption in particular, because this is what is striking me more and more, and that is that corruption and violence and tyranny are just three sides of the same phenomenon.
Definitely. And what is heartbreaking is that our current crop of leaders, and not just in Zimbabwe alone, if you are just looking at their journeys from liberators at one point, liberators that we celebrated in the case of my generation, who really were brought up in those golden years of promise, and how they quickly morphed into versions of the oppressors that they claimed to replace. And, you know, it's a question of power and how power has been, how that power has sort of been corrupted for personal gain, personal profit. There's a reason why most of our leaders are filthy rich, for instance, even though most of our citizens, most of our countries are poor. It's a disparity that really doesn't make sense. And in order for that state of affairs to persist and stay, tyranny has to come into play, because you need the violence. They need the violence to actually keep their positions, to keep their empires running, for lack of a better word. So it is a vicious circle that we have to find a way to dismantle if we are going to be free.
And then, so to go back to that, losing the people, you know, losing their fear, you say something I think really beautiful, and that is that we discovered that the only way to be a better Jidada was to start by being each other's treasures. So when you lose your fear, something else is born out of that. Talk about that.
When you lose your fear, I think you make everything possible, everything in the sense that the tyranny is counting on you to kind of stay in your lane. When you lose your fear, you lose that lane. You have no lane to stay in. There are no boundaries for you to observe. And by extension, if you lose your lane, if you lose your boundaries, you become interested in what is happening to the next person. You talk to the next person, and hopefully through that process, you also realize that you are pretty much in the same predicament, regardless of these artificial borders like class, like race, like gender, as it happens in Jidada at the cusp of the true revolution. People realize that they are actually bound together, that there is some need of solidarity, that their story is a collective story. And sure enough, you know, people from all across the country flock down to this one tiny location called Lozike and just decide to stand up. They are fearless for the very first time in history, to the extent that their government is actually shocked. I think there's a moment when they're having an emergency conference and the president demands to know what has happened to the fear, because he has spent so many years working on that fear. He wants it back. because he also has the knowledge that without that fear, he cannot exist.
Have you ever seen people lose their fear?
There has been moments. I think just thinking back to some of the things that have been happening across the world when I wrote Glory, I know in Zimbabwe after the 2018 election, an election that was contested, there were so many irregularities. I saw people go to protest knowing what they were dealing with. Of course, things turned violent, and I think about 7 people lost their lives. I saw them lose their fear again a few months later in January. Again, we saw the biggest waves of protest that I'd ever seen in my lifetime. So those were moments that I felt, okay, this is what losing your fear looks like. And I actually owe some of Glory, some of my thinking around Glory to that kind of moment.
It's such a powerful, powerful novel. No Violet Bulawayo, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It's a book that shocks and inspires, and it's just a terrific story. Thanks again.
Thank you.
No Violet Bulawayo. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an excerpt from Glory. Next up, a gripping tale about abortion. Stay tuned after the break. That was Zimbabwean musician Stella Chiweshe singing Chachi Murenga. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week, the Oklahoma state legislature passed a total ban on abortion. It's almost certain not to be the last state to do so. A basic constitutional right is hanging by a thread that the right-wing Supreme Court is likely to cut in the near future. All the more reason why Jennifer Haig's new novel, Mercy Street, is so important and timely. It grows out of her experience volunteering as a counselor in an abortion clinic and follows Claudia, an abortion counselor in a Boston reproductive care clinic called Mercy Street. With her inimitable flair for character and plot, Haig explores a polarized America where the real needs of women and their families fall prey to the twisted motives of misogynists and ideologues. Jennifer Haig is the author of numerous books and has been a guest on Writer's Voice several times before, including her last novel, Heat and Light. Jennifer Haig, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's great to be back.
You know, the last time we spoke with you was about Heat and Light, which was just an amazing, wonderful novel about fracking. And now we have another amazing, wonderful novel about abortion, a tough topic to talk about, Mercy Street. This is a stunning novel. And by the way, congratulations on Richard Russo's New York Times review of Mercy Street, which was a rave review. He even called it such. And, you know, he says something that is, I just got to read it out to you because it is so perfect. It says, far from being depressing, the book is wonderfully entertaining, boasting a large, varied cast of vividly drawn characters whose company readers will find deeply rewarding. And I guess that's what I want to ask you about. You know, fracking the last time, abortion this time. You take up really weighty subjects. What is your thinking about exploring them in a way that really draws in the reader?
You know, Francesca, in both cases, Heat and Light and Mercy Street, I really backed into the subject. I never had any intention of writing a novel about fracking, nor about abortion. Both of those books came about in kind of indirect ways. So Heat and Light, my last book, is set in Western Pennsylvania in this part of the world that I'm always writing about. I grew up there. I wrote a novel called Baker Towers and a collection of short stories set in this place. So when fracking came to Western Pennsylvania, it was just a foregone conclusion that I was going to end up writing about it. I would write about whatever happens in that place. So it wasn't convictions about fracking that motivated me. It was my engagement with that landscape and those people. So it was accidentally I wrote a book about fracking. And in a way, Mercy Street is similar in that at the time I started writing it, I had been volunteering for some years at a women's clinic. It was something I did not because I wanted to write about this, but because I believed in the work they were doing at this clinic. And it was only after I had volunteered there for some time that it became clear to me that I was going to have to write about it. And I remember having this sinking feeling like, oh my God, what am I doing? Nobody wants to read a book that deals with abortion. You know, there is no more polarizing subject in our culture. And here I am preparing to do some cartwheels down the third rail. So it seemed like a bad idea on the one hand, but on the other hand, it was something I cared passionately about. And I've learned from experience, you know, this is my seventh book. There's no way I'm going to live through the endless process of writing a novel unless I'm writing the thing I care most urgently about at that time. And that's how Mercy Street came to be.
And a very timely topic. When you began, did you foresee where we would be now on the brink of the overturn of Roe versus Wade?
No, I never would have imagined we would be at this juncture in 2022. I started writing this book, I guess it was in early 2016, and the horizon looked quite different at that point. That was a few judicial appointments ago. I was simply having this experience as a volunteer that I found very compelling. And, you know, it led naturally to the writing of this book. So at this clinic, I was working as a volunteer on a hotline. I was answering phone calls from mostly women. Occasionally a man would call, but their callers were mostly women. They often had questions about contraception or wanted to schedule gynecological checkups. But in many cases, they wanted to schedule an abortion. So I'd say maybe 40% of the callers to this hotline were abortion calls. And it was such an odd and in a way privileged position to be in, to be privy to women's thoughts as they were making this very momentous decision, very personal decision. Many of the women who called had made up their minds and were very clear about what they were doing and just wanted to schedule the appointment and get on with their lives. But there was a subset who still needed to process the decision they'd made and wanted to talk about their reasons for ending a pregnancy. And I can remember the exact moment when I knew I was going to have to write this book. There was a caller to the hotline who wanted to schedule an abortion. And she told me, well, I can't be pregnant because if my ex finds out I'm pregnant, he's going to come to my house and shoot my kids. It was such a jaw-dropping moment. In fact, this memory of mine appears almost verbatim in the novel Mercy Street. It's something that happens to my character, Claudia, when she's answering calls on this hotline. But I remember when this woman said this to me, I thought, oh my God, I really don't know anything. You know, I'd been pro-choice my whole life. And I thought I had some understanding of the reasons why women choose abortion. But I will tell you, that had never crossed my mind, that that might be a reason someone would make this choice. And as my character Claudia says in Mercy Street, well, you know, I had no way of fact-checking whether that was true. Maybe she was delusional. Maybe she was paranoid. Maybe she was crazy. You know, this is just a stranger calling the hotline. There's no way to verify what she's saying. But at the time, I was inclined to believe what this caller was saying. And it just hit home to me, something I'd thought about many times before. Women are the best judges of what they need and what their lives require. And it is simply impossible for a stranger to guess the reasons that go into a woman's decision about ending a pregnancy. So if ever it was clear to me that women need to retain that right, it was clear at that moment.
Absolutely. And in fact, I believe in the book that's in response to a guy who says, well, you know, I support abortion if it's for a good reason. And Claudia brings that up, but she's really making a larger point, isn't she?
Yeah. So Claudia's answer to that question is there's always a reason. Define good. And you realize that the definition of good is in the eyes of the person making the decision. And women's reasons are, you know, often very personal, not things that they necessarily want to talk about with strangers. But I think as a society, we have to trust that they have reasons and are the best judges of whether those reasons are good.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so tell us a little bit more about Claudia Birch, because she's a wonderful character, and she comes from a background that's very familiar to those in your books.
Yes. So I feel that in every one of my books, in one way or another, I'm writing about class. It's one of those subjects I come back to again and again, in part because of where and how I was raised. So I'm from a working class background. I grew up in Northern Appalachia, in coal mining country. And the people surrounding me were working class people too. So it's very natural for me to write about working class characters in my books. That's not currently in vogue among writers of literary fiction. I don't know too many other contemporary writers who are interested in such people, but those are my people. And Claudia comes from that sort of background. She was born to a single mother. Her mother, Deb, was 17 when Claudia was born. Claudia has never known her father. And she grew up in, you know, fairly difficult conditions. So when Claudia was a kid, her mother regularly took in foster children to help make ends meet. So at any given moment of Claudia's childhood, there were two or three or four other kids sharing this single wide trailer that Claudia and her mother lived in. And that background has informed all of Claudia's decisions in her adult life, all her ideas about family, about motherhood, about marriage, about the lives of children who were not necessarily wanted or born into ideal circumstances. All those ideas about the world came from her early life experience. So Claudia, as a counselor at this clinic, regularly meets young women who remind her of her own mother. You know, young girls who find themselves pregnant far before they're ready to take on that kind of responsibility. And Claudia's compassion for the women who come to the clinic, it very much draws on her early roots.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Jennifer Haig about Mercy Street, her latest work of fiction. Yeah, you say that their lives of the women, many of the women who come, are like a burning building with a fire on every floor. So talk about that context in which, I mean, I was surprised to see that because I would think that, you know, a middle-class woman would go to a women's clinic that offered an abortion. But you're saying it's really a lot of women who have a lot of fires burning on all their floors.
Francesca, in fact, it's everybody. And you know, one of the things I found so striking about this experience working at the clinic, that it was probably the most diverse, inclusive sampling of women I had ever seen in the city. You know, there were women who were certainly from middle class or upper class backgrounds. There were college students. There were professional women in their 30s and 40s who were quite successful. And there were also women who were indigent, who were living in extreme poverty, and everything in between. There's one scene in the book where Claudia is counseling a girl who's a senior in high school. She goes to a prep school and finds herself pregnant. She schedules an abortion and she comes in with her mother. Her mother is supportive of her decision to end the pregnancy. This young woman has just applied to colleges and she's in the midst of choosing between Yale and Princeton. So that's where she's coming from. And on the very same day, Claudia sees another young woman of about the same age who is a homeless heroin addict. She detected her pregnancy when she overdosed on heroin in a gas station restroom. And the station manager found her, called an ambulance. They took her to the emergency room and did an ultrasound. And that's how her pregnancy was detected. So on the very same day, these two young women from the same city have scheduled procedures and have come to end pregnancies. So really, these questions of contraception and abortion land on every woman, regardless of her background, regardless of what part of the city she's from, or her socioeconomic status, or how much education she has, or her race or cultural background. If you are born in a female body, sooner or later, you're going to confront some of these questions, contraception, abortion, gynecological checkups, preventive health care. These are the services this clinic provides.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've certainly been there myself, and I won't even ask about you because it is so common.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, there's also someone in the book, and it might be more than one person, who says to Claudia, I don't know how you can work here. And she thinks, well, you know, she hears that question a lot. Is that something you also heard? And what do you think is behind that question?
I think it reflects people's assumptions that a clinic like this must be a miserable place. And in fact, it isn't. I mean, most of the patients who came to the clinic were not, in fact, there for abortions. They were there for annual checkups. They were there to get prescriptions for birth control pills. They were there to get antibiotics to treat a urinary tract infection, just regular health care. And it's something I found, frustrating about working at this clinic. Every time I showed up there to work a shift, I had to walk past a gauntlet of protesters. Some days there were a whole bunch of people there. Other days there was maybe only one person holding a sign. But the assumption clearly was that anybody who comes to a clinic like this must be having an abortion. And in fact, it wasn't at all true. Most of the people who came to the clinic were not actually pregnant. This experience of showing up to work and having to deal with blowback from people who were making this assumption was really deeply unsettling. And when I wrote the character of Claudia, I gave that a lot of thought, what that would be like if that is part of your daily. There I was just a volunteer. I didn't go there every day the way Claudia does. That is her full-time job. And every day she has to deal with this kind of this resistance and these assumptions from protesters outside the clinic. That experience of encountering this kind of opposition on a daily basis, it becomes routine for her, but it never really becomes normal. She's a person who works in this pressure cooker sort of environment. And part of what the novel is exploring is the effects on her, how this affects her psychically, how it affects her daily life.
Yeah, there's a certain point where a video of her goes viral because somebody holds up a sign saying, and I've actually, seen this sign in pictures anyway, a sign saying that abortion causes breast cancer. And she starts out very rationally and then she totally loses it. Is that something of what you're talking about here?
Yeah. I mean, think about that on its face. It's a ridiculous assertion. Of course, abortion doesn't cause breast cancer. But what is particularly evil about that is that, breast cancer is a terrifying illness. In many ways, it's the illness women fear most. And for Claudia, it was just unspeakably galling that this male protester is carrying this sign, basically threatening women with breast cancer if they end their pregnancies. And yeah, she completely loses it.
Yeah. And so talking about the men, you have actually a couple of kind of incel characters, one of whom is Victor Prine, who hails from Bakerton, which we've seen in your other novels. He is a toxic brew of resentment, patriarchy, and racism. Tell us about Victor Prine and, where he comes from in your psyche in writing this book.
Well, you know, when I was writing the novel, I knew that there would need to be an antagonist to Claudia. And when I was thinking about who that character might be, naturally, I thought about where I grew up. So in my hometown in Western Pennsylvania, this is a very common sight. You see these homemade signs along the highway. They're not mass produced. Somebody actually has gone to the lumber yard, bought the lumber, cut the lumber, painted the signs with anti-abortion slogans, and planted them by the highway. So this was a common sight in my childhood, these homemade signs that say, it's a child, not a choice, or abortion stops a beating heart. And so I found myself thinking about who makes these signs? Who does that? What kind of person would go to such lengths to express this opinion? And that was the germ that led me to develop this character, Victor Prime. It was very natural to me to make him from the same part of the world that I'm from, because, you know, there are plenty of people there who hold these convictions about abortion. I know from personal experience, I grew up in this small town. It was socially conservative, overwhelmingly Catholic. I was hearing about how bad abortion was before I even understood how you got pregnant. So through all my childhood, I was absorbing this kind of anti-abortion rhetoric. And it made sense to me that Victor Prime might be from the same kind of place.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Jennifer Haig about Mercy Street, her latest work of fiction. And what does it come out of? I mean, surely, as we've just been talking, many, if not most, of the women in the clinic in Mercy Street come from, you know, backgrounds of poverty where it's really difficult to have and support a child. You're talking about Bakertown, you know, a town in the Rust Belt, where people are struggling. Why, and so long ago, I mean, you know, why did this turn to, you know, this anti-abortion fight above all else? You know, and I guess I'm also asking a question about how do people figure out what's in their own interest?
Well, those are really two separate questions. I mean, I think people oppose abortion for many reasons, and maybe most of them have to do with religion. Victor Prime is an interesting character to me because his reasons for opposing abortion have nothing to do with religion. He's not Christian. He's in fact an atheist. His convictions about abortion come from a darker source. A little bit more about Victor. He's an older guy. He's a Vietnam vet. He has spent most of his adult life as a long distance trucker. So he's alone driving for years and years on end. And what he has done to pass the time is listen to talk radio. And over the years, he got very attached to this one particular talk radio host, Doug Strait, who talks a lot about race. And Victor's convictions about abortion really stem from not wanting white women to have abortions. He's fine with women of color doing this. His real concern is that he feels that he is becoming part of a minority group. He sees that birth rates among white women are lower than birth rates among other women. And he starts to feel that, you know, that white people are losing their agency. They're losing their control in the society. And he thinks by opposing abortion, he can help to counteract that. So it's a very twisted way of thinking about that. And a lot of that has to do with being deeply lonely, having no other company except the voice on the radio when you're driving and driving for years on end. And, you know, I hate to say, I don't think that's an uncommon experience.
No, that's true. But then on the other hand also, I mean, he's a type that we have seen more and more, you know, or I think emerged maybe from the shadows of the media, you know, certainly was there beforehand during the Trump administration and, you know, has only gotten stronger since. What are some of your thoughts on how often it seems that white working class people and white low-income people are motivated by these wedge issues of abortion and, you know, Black Lives Matter and, you know, the fear of being overtaken, rather than, you know, getting together with folks, you know, of their class who are not white?
There's lots to unpack in that question, Francesca, and I'm not sure I'm the best person to speak to all of it. I will say this, the influence of talk radio has been powerful, and I don't think we have reckoned with the extent to which it has shaped the argument. And it's telling to think about who actually listens to the radio all day. It's not white collar workers. It's not people in offices. It's people who work with their bodies, people who work with their hands. You know, if you drive a truck, you listen to the radio. If you're a roofer, if you're a plumber, if you work construction, if you cut hair, those are the kinds of jobs that allow you to listen to the radio all day. So that is the audience for a lot of these people who are spewing these convictions on talk radio. It's working class people.
Yes, and I think that's a very important point to make. Finally, I want to just talk about another really delightful character, and that's Timmy, the weed dealer. I mean, he's a very sympathetic person, and weed definitely plays a role here. I just wonder where he came in your imagination, to this wonderful novel, Mercy Street.
Well, you know, I spoke earlier about this kind of pressure cooker environment Claudia works in this clinic. And I thought about the ways she might try to cope with what she faces every day at work. Timmy behaves as sort of a first responder in Claudia's life. So her way of getting through her life is by smoking a joint in the evening. And periodically she goes to Timmy's to replenish her supply, and they have a long meandering conversation and watch television. And in fact, some of my favorite scenes in the book are those long, aimless conversations between Claudia and Timmy. The weed angle also fits into this story because I was thinking a lot about legality, about how something can be socially acceptable and legal and then become illegal, or vice versa. As the book opens, abortion is still legal. Right now in 2022, abortion is still legal, but that could certainly change. Similarly, cannabis has been illegal forever, and now in Massachusetts is legal for recreational use. So at the time this story is set in 2015, the Massachusetts legislature is about to vote on the legalization of cannabis. And Timmy is a guy at a crossroads. He's never done anything in his whole life but sell weed. And he's facing the prospect of his way of life becoming untenable. He thinks of himself as someone who's about to become a displaced worker if cannabis is legalized. So that's kind of the internal tension in Timmy's life. So like Claudia, he's a person on the rails when you meet him at the beginning of the story.
And it is a wonderful story. The novel is Mercy Street. Jennifer Haig, it's been a delight to talk with you about this. And I read this in one sitting. It's just one of those page turners. I love the book.
Thank you, Francesca.
Jennifer Haig. Go to writersvoice.net to read or listen to an excerpt from Mercy Street. April is Poetry Month, and we've got a timely and apt poem from Teresa Davis about reproductive rights. She performed it at the 2015 Women of the World Poetry Slam. It's titled,
What to Do When a Politician Tries to Fall Into Your Vagina, Feet First. My body is not yours to pump, lobby, or legislate. There are no campaign funds tucked in my moccasins or in the folds of my flesh. And the last time I checked, there was no ATM in my vagina. No fuzzy slipper morning after a episiotomy. No sling back in time mentality. There simply is no room in my womb for your party to meet. My fallopian tubes are not earbuds eager to listen to your rhetoric, because all you want to do is get in my business. And you got no business being down there. I mean, if I had wanted you down there, you'd have been invited, all shiny 6-inch stiletto, but you were not invited. So now you just want to barge in all steel-toed Timberland so you can try to cross-train, tell me how to run what I've been running my whole life and what's fucked up here. Is that I understand your God complex? I mean, you've been planting your flags and other folks' intentions for so long, and some have it's not hard. But I'm thinking that if your God really wanted you in my pants, he'd have made you me. And I don't have time for your nonsense or you flip-flop agendas, stumbling on the untied laces of your misplaced metaphors, confusing women of today with those who tried to deny the right to vote with all your platforms and oversteps. And I am sure that in your supreme wisdom, you understand how this entire conversation is inappropriate. And since you cannot walk in my shoes, I'm going to need you to take them off. You are scuffing up my shine. But if you want to talk about fair housing, equal pay for women, educational benefits that ensures each and every one of my babies goes to college, if you want to talk about health care or basic human rights, I am down for that. But if all you want to discuss is how you think I should honor my body, you are wasting your breath. You cannot dictate who lives in my womb or who is evicted, and how dare you suggest I get over it. And no matter how many times you say it, there's no such thing as legitimate rape. And for the record, Rick motherfucking Santorum, women, yeah, we taught the world how to make lemons lemonade. So until the day your head screams violation, your blood begs for its breath as you lay battered, broken, some foreigner seed spilled in your sacred spaces, while those who are supposed to protect create law that make you target, victim, agenda, inconsequential as they abort your dreams while celebrating your injustice the day another human being falls from your body like grace, that's the day you get to walk in my shoes. But until then, politician, I just need you to know that when you try to get all up in here, uninvited, yeah, me, I'll be shutting that shit down.
That was Teresa Davis reading her poem, What to Do When a Politician Tries to Fall into Your Vagina Feet First. Next week, we talk with Luma Mufle about her book, Learning America: One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.